All right, so we're looking at Gideon. So if you'll find Judges, we're looking at the end of chapter 7 and the beginning of chapter 8. It's where we left off last time. I appreciate Brother Powell filling in last week. And I hope that wasn't the tipping point that put him over the edge and he kind of went down with the summer cold that's going around for a couple days this week. So I don't think he's disagreeing with me if he coughs over there. I think it's just the remnants of the cold. But anyway, I appreciate that. But the end of Judges chapter 7 is where we left off last time. Verse number 24 and 25, Gideon sent messengers throughout all Mount Ephraim saying, come down against the Midianites and take them before the waters into Bethbara and Jordan. And the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together and took the waters of Bethbara and Jordan. And they took the two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeb, and they slew Oreb upon the rock Oreb. And Zeb they slew at the winepress of Zeb. And they pursued Midian and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon on the other side Jordan. So you have here, Gideon has assembled his army. He got a big number. He cut the number down. God gives a victory with a small number. And then as the enemy's running away, he sends messengers and says, cut them off for me. So those in the surrounding areas knew the crossing points and they cut them off there. Now, either in verse number 25, either these were very fortunate names, the rock of Oreb and the winepress of Zeb. Either those places were named prophetically, and I'm speaking with my tongue firmly implanted in my cheek here, or they were named such as a result of the captures. Okay, I think that's what happened here. The one was caught and slain there at a large rock. The other caught at a winepress. So then those were subsequently named for those battles there, the rock of Oreb and the winepress of Zeb. And it's the end of verse 25. Any of you ever had a pet to bring you something as a present, whether it's a mouse or a rabbit or a skunk, kind of drop it at the doorstep? Hey, Gideon, look what we got. They brought the heads of these two guys back to Gideon as proof that they had been successful in their mission. So, I understand it. It's just probably not the kind of thing you want to talk about at the Sunday lunch table this afternoon. But, they were successful in the mission they were given. So you see, Gideon made the attack, but it was God that gave the victory. And so the enemy's on the run, but when they're on the run and it says they're beating one another down and killing one another, they didn't all die right there in the battlefield where they had encamped. There's quite a large number of them who are getting away. And so as we roll over into chapter 8, we see that there's a number that died there, but this was a massive army, and there's still some that are on the run. Chapter 8 then, and verse 1, you see the pride of Ephraim. Verse 1, the men of Ephraim said unto him, why hast thou served us thus, that thou callest us not when thou went to fight with the Midianites? And they did chide with him sharply. Now, that's kind of interesting there, because, what do we know about Ephraim? In the hierarchy of the children of Israel, what do we know about Ephraim? Remember who the father was? It was Joseph. Yep. So you have the two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. That was the double portion, the inheritance of the firstborn. And so they were used to having a prominent place in Israel. So there's always this rivalry. Reuben, we were really the firstborn, and Ephraim and Manasseh, but, God likes us better. You know how kids do that, at least, some kids do, not yours, but you've seen other people's kids do things like that, right? But you have this constant back and forth. So now remember, back in verse number 24, Gideon sent messengers throughout all Mount what? Saying, come help us through Mount Ephraim. So they were in the neighborhood. For whatever reason, that was not the backbone of the group that actually came to help him. I should have written down the verse here, but I didn't. See if I can find it here quickly. If I can't, I'll cover it later. But there were two or three tribes there, but Ephraim was not you know, one of the main ones that sent people to the battle. But now they're all upset. You didn't include us. You ever had that happen? Birthday party, graduation event, you know, anniversary celebration, you know, whatever. You didn't include us. I mean, the invitations went out to everybody. Phone calls were made, et cetera. What do you, you know, why are you trying to make us look bad? You trying to make us look like we don't care? The truth is they didn't show up, but now they realize it looks bad, so they're trying to, you know, cover it up after the fact. Why hast thou thus served us thus, that thou callest us not when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites? And they did chide with him sharply. That term chide there, you know, has the idea of a very harsh conversation, anger, sharp tones, etc. Okay, this was not a friendly conversation. Now, when somebody, you know, snaps at you like that, is your first response to be gentle and kind and gracious and magnanimous? If you are, you need to teach me your secret, okay? I mean, our temptation is to respond in kind, okay? But you notice, you see the pride of Ephraim here, but you see Gideon was very wise and humble in his response. Verse 2, he said unto them, what have I now done in comparison of you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? He said, look, I've done nothing compared to you guys. The illustration here, what's the gleaning? That's what's left over at the end. That's what was left for the poor and the helpless to have a little bit of something to eat. And the vintage, I mean, that's the best of the harvest. And he said, look, your leftovers are better than the best that we have. You know, we wish we could be you, basically. Now, whether I don't think he truly meant that in every sense, but he's trying to be kind. But it's a very humble response. And verse 3, God has delivered into your hand the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. And what was I able to do in comparison of you? Now, could any of you make an argument for Gideon here? I think I could. I think I could make an argument that what Gideon did might have been a little bit more impressive. I got a friend who is, he's not living in Iowa currently, but his family is from out that way. And when they get ready to do the corn harvest, they set up deer harvesting. You know, out in the Midwest, we got a lot of these big farms that actually will give nuisance licenses and stuff like that for deer and other things that, you know, constantly tear up and eat the crops, right? But they will harvest deer, and I mean, they will process them. They put them in the freezer. They're not just destroying them. I mean, that, they count on that for their meat for the year. But, you know, he was in Bible college, and then he was pastoring, you know, elsewhere. And his brother called him and said, hey, how many deer can you put in the freezer? And he said, I think I can fit 4. And he's like, okay, tell me how you want them cut. And, all right, they'll be in the freezer. Next time you come, bring coolers. You can take them back with you, you know. But what they do is they set up people, you know, about 50 yards apart, you know, on a certain direction. Well, then they start, some people do it with dogs, some people just do it with the combines. But they start from the far end of the field. And they, you know, they say, all right, we're going to start here and we're going to go your direction. Okay, so we're here, you know, shoot this way, you know, but they have it all laid out. But they start the combines through the field. And, you know, the deer that have been bedded down in there all summer start running. So basically, you know, it's set up for them. They're just, you know, they pick their targets and they drop them. Okay. That's the kind of deer hunting I could get behind. Okay. Deer waiting is not as much fun, where you sit in a tree and wait and hope something walks by, right? I have done it, but that kind sounds a little more interesting to me, okay? But I say that to say, who had to work harder for it? The one that had to, you know, set up the stand and analyze things and try to be there and wait it out, or the one that's standing there with a shooting lane, you know, when they start running them out of the field? Now, here, Oreb and Zeb, which way was it? Did they go search in the woods for them, or did somebody else basically flush them out and run them right to them? I mean, just like those tractors started to run the deer out to the hunters I was describing, that's really what happened here with the men of Ephraim. I mean, Gideon has gone and followed God's instructions. He's gathered an army. He's cut down the number. They went with the lamps and trumpets and all of that. And they flushed them out, ran them right into their hands. All Ephraim had to do was catch what's already running at him. Not nearly as hard. I mean, I could definitely make an argument for Gideon's job being harder and his accomplishment being more impressive. However, he was very humble. He said, look, you know what you've done? You got the trophy. You got the princes, Oreb and Zeb. I wish I could say that. I can't. You know, you guys are top of the mountain. Notice the end of verse 3. Then their anger was abated toward him when he said that. I mean, that didn't change the situation, but it calmed it down. It reminds me of what Proverbs says, right? A soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. Okay? Gideon could have been right in what he said, but he chose a soft answer. He chose to try to defuse the situation. Okay? But you see, you know, the pride of Ephraim. Well, then, in verses 4 and 5, we see the pursuit by Gideon. So, Oreb and Zeb, we sometimes think, hey, that's the end of the story. It really isn't. There are others yet to be conquered. If you you may remember, you may not, you know, we'll forgive you for that. But this was quite a large group that came in chapter 6. You have the princes of Midian, but you also have, it says, the children of the east and some of the Amalekites. I mean, this was quite a large conglomeration, okay? So, Oreb and Zeb were the princes of Midian, but there are others yet to catch. So verse 4, Gideon came to Jordan and passed over, he and the 300 men that were with him. Notice the last phrase in verse 4, faint yet pursuing them. And he said to the men of Succoth, give, I pray thee, loaves of bread to the people that follow me, for they be faint, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. So there are additional leadership here that he is chasing. That phrase at the end of verse 4, faint yet pursuing. You ever been there? I bet you have. You know, I am just trying to put one foot in front of the other. I mean, we've all been there. You know, life kind of sometimes goes in cycles, and sometimes it seems like we're stuck in that cycle, just trying to put one foot in front of the other. But you see here, Gideon was tired. He was worn out. I mean, he had had some victories. He's had some difficult things to deal with, but he's just drained, but his job's not done. So they're pursuing. Verse 5, he said to the men of Succoth, give, I pray you, loaves of bread unto the people that follow me, for they be faint, and I am pursuing after the kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna. Now, how long, does anybody remember how long that the kings of Midian have been oppressing Israel when God finally raised up Gideon as the judge? Yep, 7 years. It's entirely possible that they have kind of made their peace with Zeba and Zalmunna. Or they're like, okay, these guys have been in charge for a long time and I don't want to make them angry, right? Notice what they said in verse 6. The princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna in thine hand that we should give bread to thine army? Now, does that mean, are you holding hands with them? No. But I think what that means is, have you captured their hands? And, you know, we would use handcuffs today, but have you tied them up? Have you arrested them? Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand that we should give bread to thine army? What's the implication here? The implication is, if we help you and you don't catch them, then they're going to come back on us. We don't know that you're going to be successful, and we're not going to get ourselves in trouble with them by helping you. So, are we in the same tribe or not? You know, are we in the same, are we citizens of the same country? I mean, in that kind of, that's how I'd feel. Whose side are you on exactly? Well, the truth is, they were on the side of self. They're on the side of self-preservation. You know, that's where they landed right here. Okay, look, we're not getting mixed up in this. I hope you catch them, but if you don't, I'm not helping you and have them come back on me for helping you. All right? That's what's going on here. So you have Succoth, and then you have another city, Penuel, that did kind of the same thing. Okay? So verse number 7, Gideon said, "Therefore, when the Lord hath delivered Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." Well, okay then. I kind of like it. I mean, Gideon's demonstrating faith, right? He said, God is going to deliver them into my hand with or without your help. But if you don't help me, you're going to wish you had. Now, he didn't say he was going to kill them, but he did say he's going to teach them a lesson, right? I'm going to tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness. All right. This is getting interesting. Verse 8, he went up thence to Penuel. What is the name Penuel? It means basically the same. Do you remember? Well, you probably don't remember, but I like these kinds of things, so I remember them. But when Jacob wrestled with the angel at the brook Jabbok, and he finally figured out that it was God that he was dealing with. Anybody remember the name? He named the place something. It was Peniel, just one letter different, P-E-N-I-E-L, where this one is P-E-N-U-E-L. Both of those are transliterated into English, and both of those names, Peniel and Penuel here, both of them mean the face of God. Okay? I wonder if this was close to where, you know, the place where Jacob had named it originally, but I couldn't dig up a lot of information on the history of that. But the name, he went to Penuel and spoke to them likewise. In other words, we need supplies. Verse 8, the men of Penuel answered them as the men of Succoth had answered him. And he said unto the men of Penuel, when I come again in peace, I'm going to break down your tower. What they said is, we're going to lock ourselves in our tower, and you're not going to get us, and they're not going to get us, and you know, you're on your own, buddy. Okay, I'm going to break down your tower. So, you know, you see here, when we look at the story, who do we view as the hero of the story? Gideon. You know what I mean? With the benefit of hindsight, we know who was on God's side and where's God in all of this. The truth is, why were they in the mess where they needed a judge? Remember we talked about the up-down cycles in the book of Judges? When they got to a point where they needed a judge and a deliverer, it's because they've been backslidden for a while. And in many cases, they just kind of accepted the consequences of that instead of actively seeking for God's deliverance and so forth. So, you know, they're in that condition where, you know, they've accepted it. They've kind of resigned themselves to that fact. And so the men of Succoth and the men of Penuel, both groups refused to help him. Verse 10, now Zebah and Zalmunna were in Karkor. Okay? Now, back in verse 4, it tells us he came to Jordan and passed over. It probably should be chapter 7 and verse 4 is what I meant there. But anyway, previously it had said that there were the children of the east, and it was the princes of Midian. Okay, verse 4, it talks about the princes of Midian, verse 4 and 5. Verse 10 through 12 here, Zebah and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their hosts were with them, about 15,000 men, all that were left of the hosts of the children of the east, and there fell 120,000 men that drew the sword. Remember? Said it, you know, there was a lot of them that fell, but a lot of them that survived. Well, here you got a group of 15,000, you got a group of 120,000. Okay? So, you know, you got a lot of men that Gideon is still chasing. Now, as far as Karkor, you know, I figured I'd let Dr. Scoville tell us where that is because I have no idea. I'm just kidding. I'm just picking with him, you know. You know, the Bible dictionaries, encyclopedias, the commentators have guesses as to what it might correspond to in modern day. The truth is, you know, we're not real sure. But, you know, nonetheless, he continues the pursuit. And Zebah and Zalmunna still had about 15,000 men with them. There's 120,000 that have died, but they still got 15,000 with him. How many does Gideon have with him? I don't know. I mean, when he went to the original battle, he only had 300. Remember, he sent messengers, okay, cut them off. He may have gained, you know, a few more than 300, but do I think he's anywhere close to 15,000? Not a chance, okay? So he is still severely outnumbered. Verse 11, Gideon went up by the way of them that dwell in tents on the east of Nobah and Jogbeha. Yeah, if you know where that is, you can enlighten us, but I really don't. And smote the host, for the host was secure. I mean, there's guesses as to approximately where this is. But verse 12, when Zebah and Zalmunna fled, he pursued after them and took the two kings of Midian, Zebah and Zalmunna, and discomfited all the host. Now, you remember what he has been told in verses 4, 5, 6, 7, 8? Hey, I don't see any captives in your hand. I'm not siding with you. I don't know if you're going to win or not. And what did Gideon say? The Lord's going to give me this victory, whether you help me or not, but you're going to regret it if you don't help me. All right, that's my paraphrase, okay? But what happened? Gideon, with whatever number he had, I mean, we tend to think of the 300 and, you know, the trumpets and lamps and all that, but I still think he's severely outnumbered here. But he's pursuing, and God is still giving blessing and victory. He chases them, you know, based on what the commentators say, this is a kind of a wilderness area. In fact, some of this territory is a territory that, you know, some of the commentators think was basically a safe base for a lot of history. There was only one road in and one road out, so it was very easy to defend. There were high spots and caves and things like that. And yet Gideon chased them right into that same area, and God gave a victory. So you have the capture of the kings of Midian, the children of the east that were there with them. Why? Because they were the biggest, the baddest, the strongest. It was the elite of the special forces. No, it's because God gave the victory. But, you know, this is a continuation of the process. Now, verse 13, Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle before the sun was up. Now, he's pursuing, and if I'm following the geography correctly, and that's a great big if at this point, okay? But he's crossed over Jordan, and I believe they're going south to north, okay? But whichever direction, remember, if we back up to verses 4 and 5, what city did he come to first, Succoth or Penuel? Succoth. All right, so when he's going out, he hits Succoth first and then Penuel. If he turns around and comes back the same way, which one's he going to hit first? Penuel and then Succoth. But where did he go first? He went to Succoth first, which means he's looped around and come around behind him. Okay, he did not just turn around and reverse his track. He has gone a different route, and he went back to the first city that told him no in Succoth. Okay, verse 14, he caught a young man of the men of Succoth and inquired of him. And he described unto him the princes of Succoth and the elders thereof, even 70 men. Now that's interesting, isn't it? He had a specific target, but who was it that said no? Look at verse number 5 again in chapter 8. He said to the men of Succoth, give us help. Verse 6, who was it that said no, the start of verse 6. The princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna in your hand that we should give bread to your army? It was the leadership that made the decision. So who did he go back to punish? The leadership. Okay. He caught a young boy outside the city and said, I need names and descriptions. So he's giving them names. I mean, he was old enough to know who the leading families were and know the names of the judges and that kind of thing, right? But the elders and the judges, the princes, the leadership, 77 names altogether. Verse 15, he came to the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zebah and Zalmunna, with whom you did upbraid me. Now, he didn't show them their heads, like he had them captured here. How do we know that? Because in the end of the chapter is when they're executed. Okay? He said, look, remember you asked me if I had these men in captivity, if I had them in custody? I didn't then, but I do now. Now what do you think? What kind of toast would you like? Wheat, white, rye, you know. It's too late now. Okay, verse 15, with whom ye did upbraid me, said, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread to the men that are weary? And he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. That's a very elegant way of describing the lesson that they got. Some of the commentators say that there was a particular kind of thorns and briars that grew in wilderness. When we think wilderness, sometimes we think like desert, nothing but sand and dunes for miles. But sometimes what's described as wilderness just means what we would sometimes call, you know, prairie out where the, you know, Brother Love was for a while. It's kind of thin grass, not great for crops or whatever, but it's not completely destitute either. I mean, Doc's probably seen a lot of that in his travels out west too in different spots. But there were these briars and, you know, or vines that had these thorns on them. I don't know how to say it, but it's A-C-A-I. I don't know if it's acai or acai. I have no idea if that's the same berry that's currently, you know, real popular as a superfood or not. But there was this plant that, you know, the spelling was similar, but apparently had these thorns. And according to some of the old commentators, it was such a constant problem that the Arabians and the Bedouins and the folks that traveled in that area, they carried thorn pullers with them. I mean, be like us saying, you better have tweezers if you're going out there because you're going to have to pull splinters, you're going to have to pull thorns, you know. But so these thorns and briars of the wilderness were readily available. I don't know if any of you have the same problem that we do, but at the back of our yard, there's just these green, you know, vines that grow up with thorns. No flowers, no roses, nothing positive, just, I don't know what it is, but it's really aggravating. You know, I've seen it, you know, all over our area, but it's not blackberry vines either. I mean, if you let them grow, there's no blackberries on them. It's just thorns. So, I mean, that's what I think of, something like that. But if he went and used those, you know, was that a whip? I think he kind of threw it on them and raked it over their skin. He taught them a very painful lesson of you should have sided with God. You know what's interesting? By not siding with Gideon, they did not side with the God of Israel. Now, they have kind of gotten used to it. Remember, the backsliding and the idolatry is why they're in this circumstance to start with. And a lot of times that was years of idolatry and then years of oppression. So, I mean, if 7 years of oppression, it wouldn't be a stretch to say they've been 10 years, you know, in more of a idolatrous, backslidden condition. Could have been longer than that. But when it came right down to it, they chose to, in essence, side with the status quo instead of siding with the God of Israel. So now they're reaping for that. Okay, you have the punishment then of Succoth. But it's interesting that Gideon looped around and went there first, and then he goes on to Penuel. Verse 17, the very succinct short statement about Penuel. And he beat down the tower of Penuel and slew the men of the city. Now, he did not do that with Succoth. He didn't kill everybody. He didn't even kill the elders. He just taught them a lesson. So this is my hopefully educated guess. I think when he went against Penuel, they fought back. They tried to defend themselves. Hey, what he said is, I'm going to break down your tower. That was their stronghold. That was their fortress. That was their place of defense. And basically, they said, we're going to go in our tower and we're safe and you're on your own with those guys. He's like, I'm going to break down your tower when I get back. I think they probably came out and defended themselves, and which is why, you know, the men there were killed. Because they, in essence, initiated a battle against Gideon and his men. But you have the punishment of those who didn't side with God. Okay, verse number 18. Then said he to Zebah and Zalmunna, what manner of men were they whom ye slew at Tabor? And they answered, as thou art, so were they. Each one resembled the children of a king. Now, did Gideon resemble, you know, a prince? Possibly. Is this flattery an attempt to save their lives? It's possible. I don't know for sure. Okay? But, I mean, if I'm captive and this is the guy that is, in essence, my judge and possibly my executioner, I'm not going to do anything to insult him or make him mad at this point. But they look kind of like you. Verse 19, and he said, "They were my brethren, even the sons of my mother. As the Lord liveth, if ye had saved them alive, I would not slay you." And he said unto Jether his firstborn, "Up and slay them." But the youth drew not his sword, for he feared, because he was yet a youth. So it seems like, you know, he went back to Succoth and to Penuel and dealt with them. But now he's working his way back home. I mean, from the term that's used here for youth, this is a term that's used of a young boy all the way up to, you know, when they were considered an adult man. This is the exact same term that was used of David when it, you know, it says you're a youth and he's a man of war from his youth when Saul was telling him why he shouldn't go fight Goliath. Okay, so his son here is at best what we would call a teenager. Okay, he was not an adult, so and he would not have been part of the army that went to the battle originally. So I think, you know, Gideon's back towards his home area here. But he tells his son, "All right, look, they killed our family members, you know, kill them." And his son, you know, didn't want any part of that. He was still too young for that. Verse 21, then Ziba and Zalmunna said, Rise thou and fall upon us. For as the man is, so is his strength. You know, there was a custom there that, I mean, if I'm going to be killed, I want to be killed by a warrior, not by a child. Kind of interesting. They knew they were going to die, but they wanted to, in essence, have an honorable death. Okay? So they died. But Gideon did not only demonstrate faith in God in the pitchers and lamps and that kind of thing, right? He demonstrated trust in God in cutting down the army, in the pitchers and lamps, in chasing after the remaining princes and all of that. And there was quite an extensive amount to the victories of Gideon. So we will pick up there, Lord willing, next time and finish out, you know, chapter 8 and finish out the story of Gideon. But may the Lord help us to be on the side of the God of heaven and not on the side of the status quo. Lord, thank you for your word, and thank you for the lessons we can learn, the encouragement. And Lord, I pray that you'd help us to trust you when we can't see the outcome as these had to do. And Lord, I thank you that you'll give us the same victories you gave to each one of these. Now we pray your blessings on the church service to come in Jesus' name. Amen.